I've learned that death is not the end of the new flesh.
Long live the new flesh. I was hoping you'd be back.
Welcome to the New Flesh podcast. My name is Brett Arnold at Brett Redacted on Twitter. I'm here with my co-host Jesse Hassinger at Rock Marooned on Twitter. And we're here for a very special midweek bonus episode, a bonus episode that is not on our Patreon, is actually on the main feed, because we need everybody to know about a movie that is on Netflix right now from a long time. I'm gonna call him a friend of the show in the truest term possible, the truest way that could possibly be conceived. Patrick Bryce is here, ladies and gentlemen, director of several movies you love, including The Overnight, Creep, Creep 2, Corporate Animals, and now Netflix's There's Someone Inside Your House. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's going great. Good to see you. So glad to have you. I was looking through the archives, the New Flesh archives, going through the big, shelving and all the manila folders that I have in a case somewhere. You were on in 2016, because I didn't have a podcast in 2014 when Creep came out. We talked about Creep back in back then. And then you were on in 2017 to talk about Creep 2. And now your star has risen so much in the ensuing years. So do you...
That Netflix money.
Yeah. Do you attribute that entirely to the New Flesh podcast, or just some of it?
I can point a direct line, a red thread that has carried me by your podcast, the entire, and by your listeners. I really appreciate, and big shouts to everyone out there.
That's why you're my favorite guest. You just went right with it. Thank you.
Well, I also love it that I think when we were talking about Creep 2, I think all we talked about was fish when I was on the last time. So yeah. We can move away from jam band speak, but also that was an integral part of that movie. So,
I'm so glad we got to talk about it. I want to say it was ahead of the movie coming out, but maybe I don't remember. It was a delight to talk about it and to talk about the creation of that song for the movie, the jam band related song.
Which, by the way, has a life on the internet, because, the person who made it never really admitted to making it. And it has attributed it all to this long lost jam band that doesn't exist from New Hampshire. And so if you go deep, there's a Reddit thread. And I think there's also the YouTube comments under Albert Natural's Sarah Loves Her Juicy Fruit. It's just a bunch of confused guys, just wondering what the fuck is going on and trying to find this band, which is by design. Right. But
so you haven't revealed who actually is behind it.
We never have. No.
And you never will. Or can I get great. Perfect. I'd prefer.
We've thoroughly confused four dudes. There's four dudes in America that are what is that? Where is this band?
They're going to spend the rest of their lives in an under the Silver Lake quest.
Yeah.
To find out what the hell that song means.
It's like the most targeted dumbass in joke you can possibly put in a movie ever, but I love it. I live for it. You got to give yourself a little present every day, like Dale Cooper says, so that's my little present.
Absolutely. And I'm definitely going to bother you more about Creep later on, but I'm really excited to talk about your big movie on Netflix that's in the top 10 as we speak. We're striking while the iron's hot. I'm glad we got you. So just talk about, I would like to know how the whole thing, how do you get this movie? Is this something you approach Netflix with? Is this something they approach you with? What's the genesis of this project?
Sure. Yeah. So let's see. It was, 2 years ago now, almost 2.5 years ago, before Corporate Animals was going to premiere at Sundance, I got sent this script. For There's Someone Inside Your House, which already was set up at Netflix. It already had, James Wan and Sean Levy attached as producers. And I had been close and trying to find a project for years with Dan Cohen, who's Shawn Levy's kind of main producer. And he did Arrival and he did Love and Monsters. He's just a great dude and a friend. And we had been looking for something to work on together. And, you know, most of their stuff is like pretty like firmly planted in the mainstream. And, you know, I'm sort of like more left of center when it comes to their, you know, like their sensibility. And so, you know, it was really refreshing to get a script that, like, you know, I saw myself in some ways, and that, like, I saw an inroad and I saw, like, you know, a reason for, like, me to be making it as opposed to anybody else, you know. And I think part of it is because, you know, the script was trying to do a bunch of different things at once. You know, it was trying to be like the pitch was basically like a John Hughes movie that happens to have a slasher in it, you know. And I think because I came on board, it ended up being a bit more of like a Richard Linklater / Alexander Payne adjacent movie that has a slasher in it, you know, and which has been funny. You know, we'll get to the response at some point. And obviously, like, I'm a masochist and I've just been like looking at every single comment every single person writes on the internet in real time, which is not a healthy way to live your life. But also, like, very funny and silly and just like weirdly indicative of what happens when your movie comes out on Netflix. I've likened to it that, like, your movie comes out on Netflix and people just start yelling at you for 2 weeks, basically, whether they like your movie or not. It's just like people are screaming at you about this free thing that appeared in their house, you know? but yeah, we were trying to do a bunch of different things at the same time. And like basically the fact that it was like not only a chance to, you know, play with bigger toys than I've ever been able to play with as a filmmaker, and like, you know, actually like craft narrative sequences in a way that I've never been able to do, just because like my life up until this point has been, okay, you have $3, you know, go make a movie. And so I was excited about that. And then I was also excited about, like, you know, like a slasher movie that actually explored character, and a slasher movie that like also had like a teenage girl reading poetry in the middle of a cornfield. Like, is that something that I can make work? And, you know, and I think we're like definitely walking the line of like, this could be like overly sentimental, or this could just like, you know, these could be tones that just don't mesh well together, you know? But I was really grateful to have, like, I think a studio and producers who are really strong, and actors who I think just did an amazing job of, you know, finding these like great naturalistic performances within all that. And we're just like good people and really easy to work with. You know, I'd never worked with young actors before. And so that was kind of like my main like worry going into this, was I didn't know what that was going to be like. First of all, I thought they were going to like have me cast like kids with like
full grown adults.
Yeah. or like TikTok stars with like six packs and like weird haircuts.
Yeah, this is the studio that brought you the Addison Rae. She's all that.
It's I think you gotta get Addison Rae and Ben Platt opposite each other and it'll be perfect. The two right, cons of teenagers.
I think that's what the world wants too. I think there's a huge demand for that. But what's funny is that, like, I mean, part of that response thing is like, you know, like, I think, you know, obviously, you know, they're giving us millions of dollars to make this movie, right? So I think it's, and right, obviously they're looking at like who watches their shit and why, and what demographics, and they're saying, okay, well,
they're very tight-lipped about that, even with you guys, right?
Oh yeah, they don't tell us numbers or anything. You know, I mean, I think that like Netflix top 10 is just like, I don't even know if that's there for like the viewers. I think that's there to just like throw the filmmakers a bone and like, so the executives like won't get a call that week, like asking how many people watched our movie, you know?
Yeah. Amazing. So could you have made this movie without making Corporate Animals first? Cause I feel like Corporate Animals, to me, in your filmography, it was that a big jump in budget, even that, from Creep to that?
Yeah, I mean, Corporate Animals was I think just under $3 million movie. But you know, I still was in the same position I was in when I was making The Overnight or in Creep or Creep 2, where, like, you know, we had $3 million, but we had 18 days to shoot that movie, where we built an entire cave set, and every scene in that movie, for the most part, is 10 actors in the same scene every day. So like shooting coverage was just a total nightmare. It was just, I mean, it was really hard on the actors having to shoot, that much coverage for every scene every day. Like, I think it drove everyone crazy. It was helpful because like they're going crazy in the movie, but yeah. It wasn't helpful in terms of like, morale. That's for sure.
Sure.
We all kind of just peaced out at the end of that movie. I mean, I love all those actors are so fun and funny and were great to work with, but it was pretty grueling. So it was nice to like go into this movie where, you're always in the same position where you're fighting time, but at least I had like, it was like 30, 35 days to shoot this one.
I was going to ask, okay, and where did they shoot, in Canada?
Yes. we shot it entirely in South Vancouver, which is funny because I'm getting I got like a kid DMing me the other day that was like, what the fuck do you know about Nebraska? You're probably from California. And it's like, yes, yes. And also we shot this movie entirely in South Vancouver. And
is it where Netflix has one of their big studios, or is this
they don't have a studio there yet, but it is like Hollywood North up there, where they just shoot a bunch of things. And we got really lucky because I think there was like four or five actors that we were able to travel from our main crew, from our main group of kids, and then every single other actor had to be cast locally. And there's a lot of folks working up there, but it's a lot of folks going kind of from like CW show to CW show. It's very much a like workman-like situation up there. And so we got really lucky with all our cast, and a lot of those cases, in most of those cases, it was like the one person that could act in the 20 people that they showed us, we had to choose. And then they ended up being great. Like the kid that's in our opening, like I love him to death. He's so good.
Yeah.
And he's also like very conventionally hot. And I think he's like on Riverdale and stuff like that.
He looks like a CW type for sure.
Totally. Totally. But then he also like, if you get him in a close up and he starts like quivering his lip, he's got like some like weird jock vulnerability to him that was really nice. And
Yeah. And go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, it'd be fun to watch him get murdered.
Absolutely.
Spoiler alert.
I'm going to be push up my glasses and be the pedantic. I just read the book guy, because I did just read the book, and I'm not going to bore you with any of that. I just want to say, for the listeners, if you want to get pedantic about the differences between the book and the movie, join the Patreon, where I will be doing that with the newly formed and nary an episode recorded, the New Flesh Book Club, which, because I've read a series of horror books lately, the most recent being There's Someone Inside Your House, and I quite enjoyed it. One thing I will say I did enjoy is that it has this really great opening sequence in the book with the egg timer, and that's the opening sequence in the movie, and I love that. But the movie, I don't want to talk about all about this, but there's a lot of differences between characters, like major things in the book that are different in the movie, which I always appreciate as someone who likes to read the book and then watch the movie. Like, I'm all for a straight adaptation, but I also like when there's curveballs thrown with who ends up being who and whatnot. So it's definitely a worthwhile experience to read the book and watch the movie. I just wanted to say that if you're on the fence, I'm very picky with horror books, and I found it really compelling. And what you were saying about the John Hughes stuff, the one thing I was so surprised by is that the book is even, I feel like, has even more of that romance between the lead character and Ali McConaughey. It's a great book. Plugging Stephanie Perkins, is that the...
Yeah, Stephanie's fantastic. I mean, she, sort of cut her teeth as a romance YA novelist. That's kind of predominantly what she did before There's Someone Inside Your House. And then she actually just released a new book called The Woods Are Watching, or The Woods Are Always Watching, which I haven't picked up yet, but I'm excited to check out. But she's, definitely loves doing horror stuff. And I think this, it was really nice actually she came out to set and met everyone, and we were in close contact with her. And Henry, our writer, was, as reverent as possible in terms of like, including her and letting her know what changes we were going to be making. And she was just really excited about it. The thing that she said when she first read the script to Henry was, you know, this is what I would have done if I had like another year or two to work on it. And so, like, you know, that's the best, that's kind of the best compliment you can get as a screenwriter, to hear that, like, you know, someone's work is, you know, been able to be like expanded upon and, you know, made sense as a movie.
Absolutely. And I'm so fascinated to hear that she, and totally makes sense that she's a YA or romance writer, because all that stuff in the, it's so compelling, all that stuff in the book. And then when it gets to the horror, like, the movie is so gory. Thank you so much for making the movie.
Yeah.
So all the great. And I was delighted to find that a lot of the surprisingly brutal gore is on the page too, which is like good for you. Like, I was surprised, you know, from an author whose background is mostly romance stuff, that when it did get to the really hairy stuff, she like fully throated went for it.
I think, you know, once again, luckily Netflix, you know, they are kind of the Wild West, where they're like, you know, when we came to them and said like, we want to make these like hard R brutal kills, They were like, absolutely, go for it. You know, these are things that we don't like that, and like a sweet romance, like doesn't feel mutually exclusive to us. And they were super supportive of not only our approach to those and trying to like, you know, shoot them as practically as possible and then like augment them later with visual effects, but also like in terms of the overall look of the movie, you know, like Jeff Cutter and I, the DP, who shot like 10 Cloverfield Lane, and he shot the Nightmare on Elm Street remake that, you know, it wasn't great, but it looked good.
There you go.
He was awesome. And, you know, like they let us shoot it in 2.35. They like let it like look like a real movie. And so, you know, once again, just like, and also like they gave me money to storyboard the movie with this guy, John Fox, who's James Wan's personal storyboard artist. Like, he does all of James's movies. Yeah, which is just funny, because like he initially, like for like the driving through the corn maze sequence, like he initially did like a straight up Fast and Furious storyboard sequence for that, where I was like, oh John, this is great, but like I have like one day to shoot this scene. Yeah, you like, know?
How many cuts do we need here? Come on.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Wow. Did Netflix, I'm just fascinated by the timing of everything. Did you shoot pre or post pandemic?
We shot pre-pandemic.
Wow.
And we, yeah.
Must have been close.
What's that?
Then it must have been close to inching up to March 2020, no?
Yeah, we were, so March 13th, that day that kind of everything shut down, I was in Vancouver ready to do our last reshoot that we were going to do before, basically, you know, we had a month to go finishing the movie. And I'm at the Sutton Place Hotel in Vancouver, BC, which I don't know if you know about that hotel. It's like where they put all the actors up if you go shoot in Vancouver. They call it the Sutton. You know, it's like drugs, weird sex with like guest stars of like The Good Doctor, you know, and like it's a dark place. There's dark energy there. Like I think it might have been where the guy from Glee stayed before he committed suicide. Like it's kind of like baked in time style wise. And like, I couldn't, like being there alone away from my wife and kids and getting the phone notifications that like baseball shut down. Oh shit. Tom Hanks has COVID. And like knowing that, like I'm getting on a plane tomorrow. There's no way that, you know, we're going to be able to do this reshoot. It made everything, you know, take a whole year longer basically. And we ended up doing that reshoot in August. Like we had to go back in August, and that was one of the first shoots during COVID. Like nobody was vaccinated. You know, we're having to sort of shoot amidst
time when you're doing testing every like few hours or whatever, right? Yeah,
exactly. And that was also the time where like it was the height of it in LA. Like it was crazy. The caseload was crazy down here, but then up there in BC, there was like 50 cases in the whole province. So, you know, and we had to quarantine for 2 weeks. So I was there for like almost a month for a 5-day shoot.
Wow.
With my wife and kids. Yeah. It was nuts. It was nuts. It was, you know, it was like making a movie, like making a movie under those circumstances was absolutely wild. Like it was like, you know, like there, you know, as we all know, there were moments where we're like, will civilization crumble? Like, you know, will my family be able to eat? You know, my, like my mom got cancer and beat it during that time. Like it was like a crazy hard. And it's, that's what's so funny to like, come at the end of this, where this movie has been this thing that has like helped me through literally the hardest time in my life. And has been like this thing that's like, I can point to and say, this is why my family has been able to like survive. To come to the end of that and then have like the dude from IndieWire give it like a 2.5-star review or whatever is just like, okay, great. That's fucking great. Like, you know,
you're focusing. You're focusing on the wrong things. It's so funny to hear you talk about the, I'm assuming you think the reception of this movie is mostly negative, because my, I guess it's my bubble that I follow online, but everyone I know is a staunch supporter of this movie. And I'm not just being crazy. Smoke up her ass. I do mean that. Jesse's pretty, Jesse's a film critic who, as a profession more than I am. Oh, you're on mute.
Just gonna throw this to me, okay?
Yeah, no.
Answer for your kind.
No. That's what I mean. I want to say no. Jesse's a tough critic, and he enjoyed the movie.
I didn't review it anywhere, which is
Oh, we gotta get you in there, man.
Yeah. I had pals review it who are, you know, or I don't know, like yeah, who's friends with anyone.
I'm assuming you got David Ehrlich, is what happened.
I personally
I always get David Ehrlich, man, on all my shit.
Oh no!
It's like at the end of all of my movies, David Ehrlich is there to give it 2 stars. That's the inevitable thing in my life.
There's death, taxes, David Ehrlich giving.
I have to say, even hearing negative stuff about movie critics, it kind of feeds into the movie critic fantasy that filmmakers are in any way aware. I mean, actually, no, I think it's a lot of critics would be terrified to know that filmmakers are aware of anything they say. But yeah. There is a kind of sick fantasy of like, oh, like, you know, a filmmaker cares who's drawn from the AV club to review their work. Like, I'm sure many people don't. But I will say, like, you know, vis-a-vis the critic response, it's true. I hadn't looked on Rotten Tomatoes. I thought this was kind of doing better, so it's quote unquote than it is on the old tomato meter. I watched it over the weekend and my wife and I both dug it and had fun with it. And I don't need to like call out another Netflix production, but yeah, like
I was about this as well.
I was so shocked to see, because I hadn't looked up any of these numbers really. I just had because I just watched these on my own for fun and wasn't posting my own reviews or anything, just wasn't assigned to them. The Fear Street movies, at least the first one, was like rocking like an 83%. I had to be one of those people who sounds held up on numbers. I know it's binary is kind of a weird way to talk, but you know, it does measure, like, roughly speaking, 80% or so of people said like thumbs up to Fear Street, and it was like, you know, 50% or so said thumbs up to this movie. And all I could think about, why almost to its detriment, all I could think about during this movie was, man, this is doing the Fear Street thing way better. Like, in every, like, my wife and I both like said this to each other almost simultaneously, like, oh yeah, this is doing some of the Fear Street stuff that we were hoping for. We faithfully watched all three of those. And I know some people love them, and I'm glad they dug them. I don't mean to like run down Fear Street. I personally thought they
were... Lee Janiak is very talented. And I think
It's just my personal, I'm like, they did very well.
It's unfortunate the timing of how it all worked out, because I, you know, we were actually poised to come out in February, and then we ended up having to push. And then it was this thing where Fear Street had already kind of planted its flag in terms of their release date. So it's like, do we come out before it or do in February, which is a weird time to be releasing a horror movie, or do we come out in October? And so the idea was that the Fear Street, you know, sort of stardust would have dwindled enough at this point that folks would forget about it or whatever. But then
I think it has.
Our movie comes out in every single review or every single comment mentions fucking Fear Street.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to bring it up. You're going to be mad about it. Because my question is, when did Netflix make you aware that they were doing this thing? Because the genesis of Netflix getting that movie we've talked about on this podcast was like, that was like a Fox thing that got caught up in the Disney sale and Netflix ended up with it. And like,
yeah, did they just so you guys know, I mean, I didn't have to sign an NDA, so I think I'm allowed to talk about this, but I was part of a secret writer's room that helped conceive Fear Street.
Okay.
There was a group of us. It was me, Adam Wingard, Jason Eisner, Evan Katz. It was like a group of like weirdo indie filmmakers that they like hired to go be in a room for a month and come up with a franchise. And we came up with like the major beats associated with it. And then some of those folks went off and wrote the screenplays, like Kyle Killen and Zach Olkowitz. And
Netflix was involved, or before Netflix was involved?
This is before Netflix. This is when it was a Fox project.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. And Chernin. And I remember, being in the room with Peter Chernin where he's like, I love this. We're going to make this the summer of Fear Street, where we're going to release each of these movies theatrically, like one a month over the course of the summer. And I remember hearing that and being like, whoa, that's like a crazy, like, felt like a William Castle-esque, distribution model. But also, like in the room, we're like, wow, that's fucking cool. And then we left the room and I remember just all of us being like, is that going to work? Like what? Like, are people actually going to go back to the movie theater and spend like $60 to see three movies? And so, everything happens for a reason, right? And so I think the way those movies ended up coming out was the perfect way for it to come out. And I think having one filmmaker and having Lee as that filmmaker was the right choice, because like she killed it. I think, if there is any criticism, it's that it's like one idea that's kind of stretched out for too long. And that, it's that same problem that I think a lot of TV shows have, where you're watching a 6-episode show that should be 3 episodes, or a 10-episode show that should be 5 episodes, or whatever. It's like just the nature of like the model right now.
Problem, I think. Yeah. Started with the one that's like 10 hours that could have been 5 or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I pride myself, if there's anything that's a touchstone for me as a filmmaker, is none of my movies have been over 100 minutes. None of my, this movie was 96 minutes, and I think 9 of those minutes are credits. So I think it's like firmly in the 85, 86 minute range. I don't like wasting people's fucking time. I don't like my time being wasted. Like, just give me the goods and I'm going to bed, I don't know. I think, yes, I think we would have probably benefited by coming out before the Fear Street trilogy, but like, I don't know, critically, but like also that shit doesn't matter. I mean, it was nice to like get that sort of initial critical response that was all over the place.
Yes.
And then the next weekend we're the number one movie on Netflix for the weekend, I remember I literally texted the cast and our producers, the New York Times can review these nuts after that. Cause it was like, this kind of goes away. Cause like millions of people are watching the movie and having all kinds of different opinions. And, I know what I did and I'm confident in what I did. And, that was just making the best choices I could make with the information that was available to me at the time and the resources that were available to me at the time. And,
Was that the same writer's room? Because I had heard the thing that was out was that Alex Ross Perry was going to write one of them, or maybe he was in that writer's room with you, was my question.
No. Alex was attached to direct the second one and I think rewrite it, as a director. And then I don't know what ended up happening there.
Well, I think one of the things I dug about this movie is that it, and again, not to nag on Fear Street, just like what I think I liked about this movie in particular was that it felt like the funny stuff in it felt pretty organic, and like felt like it was true to the characters and it was coming from kind of a natural place. Like it was even, it's funny that you mentioned turning it from John Hughes to Linklater or something like that, because I did kind of feel that like it's not as kind of glib and like cutesy as a lot of like post 90s teen movies where they tend to be a little arch and very self-aware. And these characters are self-aware, but it just felt a little more like lived in the mode of someone like Linklater. And I was wondering if that was like you've done a lot of movies that kind of feel like they combine, stuff like The Overnight is a comedy, certainly, but it has kind of, it has, I don't know, it has a weird kind of suspense look to it, right? I don't know, like a tension to it. And, you know, Creep has like, you know, kind of a mumblecore vibe, even though it's increasingly scary. And even Corporate Animals is like obviously an out and out comedy, but there's like really dark kind of horror elements to it, especially as it
goes
on.
There's a big arm prop that gets
there's like actual cannibalism in it, right? Yeah. So it's like not, you know, it's not like a just the
actual cannibalism. There's real cannibalism.
It's filmed real cannibals.
Cannibal Holocaust-esque people are protesting it to this day. Yeah.
I should get somebody sued. So this movie struck me as like, oh, this is, you know, a really smooth blend of stuff that's kind of funny and a little bit arch, but also feels like genuinely scary and lived in. And I was wondering if you looked at it as a progression, like that, in like how it fits with your other movies, how you know were looking at it.
I think I'm always just trying to service the script as much as possible, and you know, when it comes to tone, much of that comes from casting. And so like, I think a lot of that work was done in how we chose these actors and how we chose all our leads, and choosing leads that all felt like they could, you know, obviously deliver believable natural performances, but also like were their characters as much as possible. And these kids really, you know, were able to play as close to their real personalities as, you know, in a great way. And I think, you know, like one of the moments where it's one of these things where I think like either people like get on board with the self-awareness, or they're like, wait, I'm confused. What the fuck is going on? Is when we introduce the valedictorian character, the like Tracy Flick-esque secret white supremacist.
I think is her name. Yeah.
Yeah. Katie. Who, you know, she's played by this actress named Sarah Dugdale, who's on that show Virgin River, which has been like a huge like soap opera hit for Netflix. And she's Canadian and she's great. And she like can do that very like, she just plays like she fully fucking commits and believes who she is at all times. And so like having like a Tracy Flick show up amongst these like kind of naturalistic kids, like, I don't know, for me, like, I was excited by that. I thought like, oh yeah, you know, like, I think we know in our heart of hearts that this person will probably get murdered in this movie, but also like, let's have fun with that at the same time. But I think, you know, when I look at the movie now, that is one of those moments where I'm like, oh yeah, I'm like, I am asking, I think a bit more than I would, than a normal like YA movie would in this case, you know, I want you to fully believe and give in, even when the characters are like slightly over the top or slightly, you know, broad. But I also like, I know they're broad, you know, like that's kind of the point, you know?
Yeah. Well, the core group of friends in it, I think, are, to me, seems so believable as like a little group of friends. And it was so not predicated on the kind of cliche going around the cafeteria while like, the popular kids sit here and these are the goths and these are the burnouts. And like these friends seem like, oh yeah, I get that they're kind of, this is their little group. I just like that kind of bought a lot of license, it seemed to me,
Like
have some of the other characters be a little more out there because you're sort of seeing things from the group.
Yeah. And to the same point, like, you know, you had this like group of jocks that was always going to be showing up in, you know, throughout the movie. And like, I just love the idea of like not demonizing those guys and those guys just like being kind of like dumb guys. Like, and that was like, those were like the job in my high school. Like, you know, I wasn't getting, I was getting no attention from the jocks whatsoever while I was in high school, but you know, like we weren't getting like shoved in lockers or like, it wasn't like this like super antagonistic, like 80s horror movie style relationship between the jocks and the nerds or whatever. It was more just like, these guys are just like dumbasses that I don't necessarily have anything in common with, but are kind of sweet, you know? And that's, you know, I like the idea of playing those guys that way, you know?
Yeah, totally.
How many conversations were had about how big the knife was going to be? Cause the knife
was a lot.
Very fucking big. And it's, I had to ask, a lot of conversations. Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Cause you don't want to go too small, obviously. Right. You know, because like,
rather
what's scary about
than too small, and I don't know if this is too big, but it's definitely very big.
It's on the edge of big. I think it's 15 inches.
Oh my God.
Blade. So it's like almost too big. And you don't want to go machete with this because, you know, you need him to be able to like tuck it in his trousers.
It's like the classic Scream stabbing knife, but way longer, which is perfect. Yeah. It's what you want.
Yeah, it's something that, like, once again, no spoilers, that, like, a rich kid would buy as, like, his, you know, if a rich kid was planning on being a serial killer, that's, like, you know, he would go for the slightly bigger one.
God, so true. One of the coolest things about the movie that is definitely not in the book, so it's either a creation of yours and I'm assuming probably Henry, the writer's, the killer, I guess this is a spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, but I think it's pretty safe to say the killer wears a mask of the next victim's face. And it's like creepy and featureless in the same way that like the Michael Myers mask is. But you can definitely tell that like it is the face of the person who's about to be murdered. Cool. Very cool. Where did that decision come from? I just think it's such a unique way to, because this movie is clearly, it's not like aping 90s slashers. It's paying homage to 90s slashers and stuff like that. So it's amazing that you guys found a way to, you know, make it new and exciting. Like, we haven't seen this before.
Yeah, well, all credit to Henry Gayden. I mean, that was his idea. And I think that was part of his big pitch after he first read the book was, this could be like an added layer to this to truly like make it feel like its own, you know, plant its flag as a modern day slasher movie with its own, you know, like hopefully iconic mask. And also, you know, with the subtext of, you know, this killer is revealing your deepest, darkest secrets. And also like it's you are having to confront yourself in, you know, in your last moments before you die. So it was like, there's just something so rich and fun about that, you know?
So,
then, the actual process of like getting those masks made was hilarious because like, you know, we tried a bunch of different versions of like methodology and approach to it. Like I actually was the guinea pig for it. I had a bunch of masks of my own face made and went through the process of figuring it out.
Where are they? Are they in this room?
Well, one of them's in my closet, which my wife made me hide from our children. Which they actually think it's funny. They'll see it from time to time and say, "Dad, you know,
is it really like your face, or is it more like that creepy featureless style?"
It looks a lot like my face. Part of it is because they actually like the ones that they ended up making that are real 3D printed masks of my face have eyeballs.
Oh my God!
And and the eyeballs
make a big
You weren't going to be able to see through them, and it was going to be a little more difficult. You know, there's that might be like one slight regret that I have is that
okay, that's interesting. You regret that?
It's not a regret. It's just an unknown, like what would have that been like, you know?
Yeah.
Because sometimes having those lifeless eyeballs is, you know, even scarier. But also having some like deep dark eye sockets is pretty fucking scary too, and getting a slight glimmer of eyeballs.
Like, two googly eyes or something. That's why.
That'll be, you know, it's really a pity that the disaster movie guys or, you know, the not a superhero movie guys aren't making those parodies anymore. Cause that would be the version of our movie would be just like a mask in your face with big googly eyes.
Well,
you know what I'm talking about? Who are those guys? You know, the guys.
Friedberg and Seltzer.
Talking about the quote, from two of the six writers of Scary Movie, guys.
Yeah.
I think they're still around. There's like a Fast and the Furious parody movie that went like straight to streaming. I think they have a straight to streaming deal somewhere. Like, you know how Prime Video has all these like Canadian made Christmas movies that are shot in like 10 days. I think
they were shooting them while we were in Vancouver. It would literally be like across the street. We were shooting in October or September, and there's just like Christmas shit in this parking lot, and it's all just dank and there's like exhaust all over it, and it's just been sitting outside in like the brisk, you know, cold, brittle like October of like South Vancouver. And you know that like those are just like all that shit's just being moved to another parking lot to shoot the next Christmas, you know, Hallmark or Lifetime movie or whatever.
Incredible. I had a friend who worked crew on a Lifetime movie in Connecticut, and it was amazing to hear the process. It's like 30 days all in, shooting pre and post. Like, it's all just wrapped and done. Yeah, super crazy. Do you have another project lined up that you're allowed to tell us about, or that you're not allowed to tell us about, that you vaguely gesture about?
Yeah, I mean, I just turned in the first draft of this this other adaptation that I'm doing for HBO Max with Temple Hill called The Wild. That's kind of like that's been announced. It's like The River Wild, but with wayward youth. It's like it takes place at a wilderness rehabilitation program with, like, you know, you basically, like, you know, these programs like put at risk youth or like kids who have, like, you know, avoiding jail time or whatever out in the woods together with like very little supervision and, like, you know, what could go wrong. So it ends up being this kind of like stalk and kill psycho killer out loose in the middle of the woods deal. And that was fun because, like, I hadn't written anything in a while. I hadn't adapted a book before, and you know, so I'm working on that, and then I'm attached to a bunch of stuff right now that, like, are in various stages of development. Nothing's going yet, you know, and I think, like, even with some of those projects, like, you know, and for, it's a good thing, you know, the strike is looming, so I think people are, like, trying to decide whether or not, you know, they're going to be making stuff in the next couple months based on that. Hopefully the solidarity vote was enough that, like, you know, enough of a bargaining chip.
98% turnout or something crazy.
Hell yeah. Yeah. And no, and it's stupid. Like, all they're asking for is, like, to take a lunch break. You know?
Like, completely absurd. And, like, they're asking, like, the powers that be at, like, fucking Apple. And, like that's all who needs to, like, step up and just make these calls, right? Like,
yeah.
It's ridiculous. People would be annoyed with me if I didn't ask for a Creep 3 update from you. I'm sure you knew this was coming. I of course did my Googling, and people were bothering Mark about this in July of 2020. And he kept saying, you guys wrote, I think, two different drafts that you've thrown out. So if you want to tell me anything about those, I'd love to hear it.
We haven't thrown them out.
Okay.
They're here on my desktop right now as we speak. Ooh. You know, we've actually got I think we have like 6 or 7 ideas that we've sort of beat around the bush on. And it's one of those things where, you know, obviously, like, you know, we were both like, he was doing the morning show and I was doing this movie. And so it was like hard for us to just even find the time to think about it. And part of that is just because those movies, as simple as they seem, are the hardest fucking movies to make.
Right. You have to stage them, like, very intricately, right?
Yeah, and it's all us. You know, it's like we don't have a crew. Like, you know, with the first Creep, it was just me, Mark, and Chris Donlan, our editor. And then for Creep 2, it was 5 of us, you know? And so, you know, I think one of the sort of like things that makes those movies special is like keeping that ethic, you know, going forward. And so we want to do that with the next one. And so it's like trying to conceive an idea that we can, you know, build on what we've done previously, but also
you don't want to do a big splashy Netflix gave us $10 million Creep 3. You want to keep
it. I don't know if they're going to do that. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I don't know like how they, I mean, I guess, I, you know, they, once again, they don't tell us the numbers, but you know, Mark does, like, you know, come to me and say, just so you know, like, I just made a post about this, like, sweet indie comedy I just made, like Language Lessons or whatever, that's out right now, and like 80% of the people, like, the comments are, where Creep 3 at, you know? And so it's, you know, we know there's an audience for it. And so all I'll say, and this isn't like, you know, this is the truth, we are talking about it. And we are, I'm seeing him in person this week to talk about it. So
there we go. That's some news.
Progress is being made. Let's let the internet run with that.
I forget. Netflix made Creep 2 with you guys? Or they financed
it? No. Both the films, I mean, the first one we made independently and sold to Netflix. And then the second one, we pretty much made independently, but we made it knowing that there would be a home for it.
So there's not like a outstanding deal right now with where like you don't have like a Larry David style Netflix deal where you can come back and make Creep 3 at any point. But
if you could come help advocate for that, that'd be really that'd be great. I would really appreciate that.
You're doing all right. What else, Jesse? Do you have anything you wanted to ask or?
It was nice to see like a Netflix slasher movie that was really fun to watch on a Saturday night. So it was fun.
Oh, thanks, man. These are all the scoops I have for you, Brett. I save it all for you, man.
I appreciate it. I'm going to be emailing Brad at Buddy Disgusting, like, post about this. New Flesh exclusive.
Brad, that is quick draw McGraw, man. That guy is amazing.
He is. He is. Now that we've said his name, he'll almost definitely listen.
Yeah.
We got that scoop on the Fear Street writer's room in here.
No.
I won't bother him about that. All right. Thanks, Patrick, for making time to talk with us. Congratulations on the movie. It's in the Netflix top 10. It has many positive reviews, despite what you think.
Despite IndieWire.
Yeah, despite David Ehrlich, who, you know, I agree with him, I would say 40% of the time. So that's like 60% where I don't. And he's definitely...
It's just weird to have like one person who doesn't like me, or I imagine doesn't like me.
I don't think... Yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to...
For movie critics, you have to know that we're constantly like, not that we're actually famous or anything, but as a movie critic reading your comments and stuff, you're like, it's interesting to know that there are hundreds of people who don't like me at all. Just say something bad about the new Ghostbusters and they'll be like, fuck you and everybody you ever...
Oh, yeah. Jesse wrote the AV Club review for the new Ghostbusters movie.
Oh, no.
People are mad at
him. It's our buddy Charles who got a phone call, apparently, from a rando, like, found his phone number and was like, eat a dick for not liking Ghostbusters, a movie this guy probably hasn't seen.
A movie that's not out for, like, a month and a half.
I'll say the good thing about drawing Ehrlich for a review is that I feel like he always goes long. You know, he gives attention. You know, it's always like 1,000 words with him.
Oh, you're going to get the clicks. And yeah. Well, people are clearly watching it. It's in the top 10. I genuinely enjoyed it very much. I think all the New Flesh listeners, I know there's a New Flesh listener who will enjoy being called out. I believe his name is Joe Kincaid, who read the book and recommended it to me actually before the movie came out and loved it. So just wanted to
shout out to Joe.
Thank you so much, Patrick, for making time to talk with us. Everybody watch There's Someone Inside Your House on Netflix now and be on the lookout for Creep 3, but also Bloody Disgusting headlines about conversations Patrick and Mark may be having this week about Creep 3. Okay. Bye-bye.
Mom with the new flesh.
I've learned that death is not the end of the new flesh.
Mom with the new flesh.
I was hoping you'd be back.